Welcome back. This week on the podcast, I talk with Dr. Joe Mobley. Dr. Mobley is a cardiologist and he is a heart health specialist. And to me, heart health, cardiovascular health is one of the most important health topics and one of my favorite ones to discuss. And in our conversation, we cover a wide range of topics. And some of the main ones are how to improve your heart health, exercise and heart health, symptoms and warning signs of heart problems. And we also get into the future of heart health and different types of tests and different types of things that are coming out that will be able to read your imaging to give you a better look at where you are and your current heart health or brain health or overall physical health. It's really cool, and where that technology is going is definitely the future. I really enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Mobley. He's an easygoing guy, very easy to get along with and have a conversation with. He is actually at Pelham Medical Center and Spartanburg Regional here in the upstate of South Carolina. So if you do have any issues or any concerns or just want to talk to a specialist, feel free to reach out to Dr. Mobley and his team. I have his link in the show notes. If you've been listening, Pelham Medical Center is a sponsor of mine. They're a great partner of mine, and I had the privilege of having Dr. Mobley on from their organization. And like I've said, they do such an incredible job. They're one of the top facilities in the country, could be the top facility in South Carolina and North Carolina. Their patient satisfactory is unbelievable. They're in the top 5% in the nation year over year, and they're doing some really incredible stuff over there. So no matter what you're looking for, reach out to Pelham Medical Center, reach out to their team, whether it just be for a annual check-in or if you have any other things you're looking to do. They have some incredible orthopedic procedures over there as well. So reach out to Pelham Medical Center. Reach out to Dr. Mobley if you have any questions concerning heart health or your cardiovascular health. Another incredible partner of mine is Rebel Rabbit Seltzers. Y'all know me, and I love to be as healthy as I can, or at least try to find healthy alternatives for things that I've done in the past. And I don't drink alcohol anymore, and Rebel Rabbit is on a mission to socialize smarter. We've all been drinking alcohol for far too long. To go along with this episode, it's also not good for your cardiovascular or your heart health. And Rebel Rabbit is an alcohol-free seltzer. It is infused with THC cannabis, and if you use promo code LIFE20, you'll get 20% off your order. They have two different types of, two different levels of their drink. They have a mild hair and a wild hair. So it doesn't matter if you've never used cannabis before or you're a regular user, they have something for you. But I just highly suggest you trying it. It's legal. And if you could be looking for an alternative to alcohol, you're not going to get any of the negative side effects that come along with alcohol, like headaches, hangovers, bad sleep, anything like that. You'll be able to wake up, be productive in the days following. So Rebel Rabbit, their website is drinkrebelrabbit.com. Use promo code LIFE20. You'll get 20% off your order. The link in the show notes will take you directly to that promo, to their website. You can order directly from them. It'll be shipped to your doorstep. Another great sponsor is Sphinx. Sphinx has been around for over 50 years supporting the communities they're in. For a very long time, I just thought they were a convenience store on my corner, and I stopped there all the time to get my goodies or get my gas. But I didn't know how much they gave back and what they did for the communities they are in. And they give back millions and millions of dollars to the communities and organizations that they are in. They're such a huge part of their community is being a partner in the communities that they are in. So all I ask for you is if you see Sphinx, stop in and support your local Sphinx, because I can guarantee you they're supporting your community if you see them on your street corner. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Joe Mobley. Dr. Joe Mobley, thank you for joining me. First off, how was your commute this morning? How you doing?
The commute was actually better than normal. I didn't get stopped on 85, so it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, we've experienced a lot of growth in Greenville, and when did you move to Greenville, or when did you get in town?
Well, I moved to Spartanburg in 2006.
So you've seen a lot of growth.
I've seen a lot of growth, and including here at Pelham, where we are today, at the Pelham Medical Center. I mean, this was opened, I think, within the first year we were here, and mm-hmm. there was really nothing around it, and it was not very busy. And over the last 10 years in particular, it has just exploded here. You know, so we've had an office here that I've been coming to since, I think, 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And it started slowly as well, but it's now covered. Yeah, I mean, it's boomed.
So when you moved up here, Pelham Medical wasn't open yet, but did you come up for Spartanburg Regional?
Yes. Yes. So I started with cardiology consultants. My primary practice for the first 10, 12 years I was here was in Spartanburg. And in 2017, we sort of looked at this market as a developing market, needed mm-hmm. cardiology. And so we started an office here, and it has grown. Now, we now have two providers. It will continue to grow.
Sure.
It's just that this area has boomed so much with, and this is a lot of places in general, the demographics have shifted, they're aging, and the population here is obviously growing. And so cardiology needs are, we're starting to try to plan for the next 10, yeah, 15 years as well.
I think they're extremely important too. My wife's in commercial real estate, and I saw all those new office buildings across the street and stuff, and I was texting them to her, and we were joking before we started recording that you Alabama boys are making quite the team up here. What was the move for you? And I know you went to Tennessee for some of your residency, but what got you to South Carolina?
I went to undergrad and medical school in Alabama. I went to Knoxville for my residency, and then went on to Richmond, Virginia, for my fellowship. When my wife and I, my wife and I grew up together. We're both from Alabama. Families are in Alabama. We wanted to be further south, closer to family, and I interviewed really from Mobile to mid North Carolina, mm-hmm. Pinehurst area.
Yeah.
We really like this area. It reminded us a lot of where we both grew up in North Alabama. We like the people. It was a good opportunity from a practice perspective. So, at the time our kids were very young. They're now in college. They've grown up here.
You're pushing 20 years here.
Mm-hmm. Almost 20 years here. And they've done, the kids loved it here. They had a wonderful experience growing up. It's been, we've really, really enjoyed it.
Was cardiology always your focus, or how did that become your focus?
No. My wife laughs at me all the time. There were no physicians in my family. I was the youngest. I kind of fell into medicine because my parents sort of told me, well, we always thought you'd be good at that. Really had no experience in it. Went to med school, had no idea what I was doing and mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. And my wife laughs. I literally said I was going to do everything that I would rotate through. but cardiology always was the thing that really interested me from just a conceptual perspective, the physiology, the pathology. And so through time, and that's one of the great things about medical school is you really get to see everything mm-hmm. as you go through medical school. And there were things that I would check off as no,
sure.
I don't want to do that for a lifetime. But then through clinical years of medical school plus through my residency and rotations, I really became very enamored with cardiology.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I went.
With cardiology, I think about heart health. I don't know if that's completely accurate, but in your terms, what do cardiologists do? What do you do? Like, what type of issues or problems do you commonly see?
Well, it's funny. All of medicine has become so subspecialized.
Mm-hmm.
And so even within cardiology, there are different subspecialties. My subspecialty myself is as a general cardiologist, has morphed more into diagnostic imaging, diagnoses, and prevention. You know, I have a lot of partners who are jovially term plumbers, because they are the interventional cardiology world is one of revascularization, stents, things like that. And then I have partners who are electricians, who are the EP aspect of it, who deal with arrhythmia procedures, pacemakers, things like that. I liked a little bit of everything, and so that's why I chose to just do general cardiology. There were, you know, some other reasons for that as well. Number one, some of the other subspecialties have some additional call burdens that were not really to my liking, especially. But the main thing was I wanted a little aspect of everything. At this point, I've sort of morphed into, I do a lot of work with CT angiography, which is a newer technology for diagnosing underlying coronary disease.
Is it like scanning?
Yeah, it's like a CT scan. So, I mean, most people have seen or have had somebody in their family that has a CT scan, has had a CT scan. This is a very special type of CT scan from a cardiac perspective that it has that uses an advanced scanner, which has developed over about the last 10 years. And that allows for patients to get a CT scan and essentially get a diagnostic heart cath. So we look at their heart, their coronary arteries, and the sort of the revolutionary way in cardiology, this is changing things. In the past, people would have, say, chest pain, and they would come in and they would have some risk factors and they would have chest pain, and you would generally do a stress test. Which, you know, the classical stress test is you put somebody on a treadmill and you run them and you look at their EKG, or you couple that maybe with some sort of an imaging modality to do the stress test. And a lot of those patients, they were told, you're okay. You know, everything's normal. But what we found is, they may have been okay in that they didn't have a severe block, you know, 90% blockage, because that's what the stress tests are designed to pick up, or severe flow limiting blockages. But they have, what you missed was they have a whole lot of 30-40% plaque, which is not enough to cause a problem on the stress test, and is not enough to cause a problem now. But 5 years from now, it sure may be. And so the CT has really given us the ability to look and say, no, you don't have any bad plaque right now. But you have some plaque or moderate plaque, and we need to be much more aggressive with your medical therapy. And so that's really, the American College of Cardiology puts out guidelines for how we're supposed to manage people and things like that. And about a year ago, they shifted their guidelines to make the CT, if it's available, the first line evaluation technique.
How available is it?
It's currently available for, so we're just getting started with the program. We've had coronary CT, but with an older scanner. Our newer technology has been in place for about 2 months.
Dang, pretty cool.
So it's pretty new. We are currently, while we're getting up to speed, it's mostly going through the cardiology division. So cardiologists are going to see people and order it. There will be a time in the future where people's primary care doctors will be able to order those tests, and then that help sort of inflow people. If they are having chest pain in the family physician's office, they can order it,
and they would come here to get it.
Currently the scanner is down in Spartanburg, but there are plans to put one here at Pelham as well.
Very cool. Yeah. With the beginning stages of heart issues, what are things people can do to help prevent it?
Sure. So it starts early in life. I mean, what we know from you know, unfortunately, autopsy studies of younger people is that, like they did autopsy studies of some of the Iraq War soldiers who were, you know, horribly killed. And, mm-hmm. But what they saw, even in those individuals in their early 20s, mid-20s, was the beginnings of atherosclerosis were noted in a lot of those.
What is that?
So atherosclerosis is early plaque development. Atherosclerosis is essentially coronary artery disease, but atherosclerosis is an inflammatory process where due to risk factors, lifestyle, things mm-hmm. like that, you get an inflammatory reaction in the lining of the blood vessels. The body looks at that like a wound, and so it releases its the white blood cells and other cells that fight wounds and infection and things like that. They migrate into the wall of the blood vessel and they lay down plaque. And initially that plaque is in little streaks, mm-hmm. but you see fatty streaks, but through time you add additional cholesterol layers, and then the body starts to try to heal it like a bone, so you see calcium develop. So it is a process that takes decades.
Mm-hmm.
It starts early in life. So when I talk about preventative care really starts early in life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is with, you know, reasonable diet, not smoking, watching your risk factors. The biggest ones are blood pressure and cholesterol. Watching obesity and becoming overweight. Diabetes is a risk equivalent now, mm-hmm. so we don't even, I mean, if you have diabetes, we now classify you as having coronary disease.
What about, like, stress and things like that?
Stress can. I tell patients all the time, it's a little harder for me to modify stress.
Yeah.
you know, everybody has their own, but certainly levels of stress is, a high level of stress is a component to that. Mostly it drives some of these other things, blood pressure,
sure.
things like that. But early in life, if you watch those risk factors, if you exercise regularly, that's what I push my patients throughout whatever age they are throughout their life, is one of the biggest and most important things that they can do is stay active, exercise, walk,
yep.
you know, have an exercise regimen, things like that. Keep your weight under control.
Mm-hmm.
Those things help to diminish the rate of atherosclerosis development. Some of the rate is out of your control, which is genetic.
Yeah, is there hereditary stuff?
Oh, yeah, there's a huge hereditary component to this. And you can see it in families that do mm-hmm. some families do almost everything right.
Yeah.
You know, the individual watches their cholesterol, watches their blood pressure, exercises, and they still develop
mm-hmm.
plaque. But they can, if you modify those things, if you're doing what you can do, certainly the studies have shown that you can slow the progression. You may not be able to halt it, but you can slow it.
Yeah.
And then for people, especially with higher risk factors, as they reach 40, 45,
mm-hmm.
is when we start. You know, if you don't have any risk factors, you're active, you're healthy, the likelihood, you know, you don't have a family history, the likelihood of developing a lot of plaque or atherosclerosis before 50 is probably pretty low. But in our society, actually, that's fairly uncommon
yeah.
now.
And those risk factors would be like overweight or not working out.
Sedentary lifestyle. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking, family history, and then diabetes being a risk equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people who have risk factors, if they have concerns, if they're not having symptoms,
mm-hmm.
so if, you know, you come in and you say, well, you know, my I'm 35 and
mm-hmm.
my mom and dad had early heart attacks and I, you know, they smoked, but, I don't smoke and I exercise, but I'm still concerned. Mm-hmm. My cholesterol is kind of marginal, maybe a little bit high. What do I need to do about this? There is actually a screening test called a coronary calcium score. And we were talking about CT. This is a different, this is a much more rudimentary, simple CT scan. It's no contrast. You can get a calcium score, and the calcium score is looking for the evidence of that calcium mm-hmm. that you saw with plaque development, and it can actually measure it. And it is a simple test. Most insurances don't cover it, but it's like $100, $150, depending on where you get it. You can get that most places. And if it is abnormal, that shows you that you have plaque, and that shifts you over, and it tells me that we need to be a lot more aggressive with your medications to lower your cholesterol, with your diet, with all these types of things. And then you also need to be more aggressive with follow-up. You have to follow those patients, the patients more.
So that would be almost like the first step if somebody didn't really have any risk factors, but they were curious to know where they were at.
Yeah, and that's what I get asked all the time. I don't have a diagnosis of coronary disease. I don't have, I've got maybe a couple of marginal risk factors. I'm 45. What do I do? Like, calcium score is a good place to start there.
With overall heart health and food and diet, you know, I feel like diet's always, people don't really know what to do. What is your suggestion for people that come to see you about how to eat? Are there certain foods? What type of diet, hydration?
Sure. So, my wife is a dietitian, so I normally defer all this to her. And my diet is probably not the best. She makes that painfully obvious to me all the time.
I call my wife the food leader too, so I put it all on her.
Yeah. So the biggest thing about your diet is to develop a diet plan that is healthy and sustainable. A lot of diets may be there, but they're very difficult to sustain for more than a few weeks at a time. And so I tell people, number one, you need to make a lifestyle change, and that includes exercise. But as far as if you're talking to me about what is a sustainable diet that is healthy, I normally tell people, you know, things like Mediterranean diets, fresh fruits and vegetables. If you're going to eat protein, lean protein, fish, chicken, things like that. No fried foods. And you can splurge. Everybody, you have to live a little. You can splurge a little bit from time to time, but you really have to have the bedrock of your diet being a very healthy diet, limiting carbohydrates, simple carbohydrates particularly. It's nothing fancy from my perspective.
Yeah.
It's not anything that requires a lot of knowledge. Most people kind of get the basics of it. It's just hard.
Yeah. And most people, I think, know the basics of it, but like, it's just hard to keep it on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, in our society, it's very difficult because, I mean, we kind of laugh about this at home. My wife and I were talking about this the other day. Both of our, or all of our grandparents essentially they grew up on farms.
Mm-hmm. Whole Foods. Yeah.
Everything was out of the garden. There was not a lot in a processed meat. You didn't go to fast food restaurants. Your life was a lot more simple. And, you know, the issue with that generation was most of them smoked.
Smoking, yeah.
They kind of offset some of their dietary improvement by smoking, but they were generally more active as well because they were out and around.
Less cell phones, all that stuff.
Right. Society now is you're at work, you're on your computer, you're sedentary, you're running out for lunch to the fast food restaurant or to get a sandwich. Kids start early where it's kind of a chaotic. Mm-hmm. They're off to school. They got this function and that function. And so it's much more difficult to really have that thought out, balanced, appropriate diet.
Yeah. And I think too, the most accessible food is usually like the most unhealthy food.
Sure. It's quick. It's on the go.
Yep.
Just grabbing it, going down the hall.
Have you seen in the industry, has there been like a spike in heart issues with this generation?
It is an epidemic.
Yeah. Okay.
we are seeing an epidemic. Now, there's a twofold epidemic. Number one, I just anecdotally, as I read CTs and things like that, and I see a lot of CTs coming through on 40 to 60-year-olds, and I would say, actually, the majority of the patients actually do have plaque.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually less prominent that I pick up people who are completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually not very common. And
when can I get a scan?
Yeah. Well, so that's one epidemic. But then the other epidemic from a cardiology perspective that we deal with is we have gotten much better about treating these people both preventatively and also for therapeutically if people are having heart attacks. Mm-hmm. You know, we have strategies to get them in the cath lab within 90 minutes,
yep.
which saves muscle, which saves, you know, congestive heart failure problems. So we've got all these downstream strategies. But the second epidemic in cardiology is with that, everyone is living a lot longer
mm-hmm.
with a lot of issues. Right now, the big epidemic that we're seeing is there is a tremendous volume of people with arrhythmia issues as they get into their mid to late 70s, 80s.
What is arrhythmia again?
Arrhythmia is really an electrical abnormality with the heart.
Mm-hmm.
The big one that is we're seeing a tremendous burden of is atrial fibrillation, which is essentially an electrical storm in the top chamber of the heart. So through time, the same risk factors for coronary disease oftentimes are risk factors for that. But age itself is mm-hmm. a risk factor for atrial fibrillation because just like your skin changes with as you get older,
yeah. it
becomes less elastic, thinner. The intracellular matrix of the atria, the top chamber of the heart, change as well. And so it leads to more chaotic electrical signals developing. And so atrial fibrillation develops. The issue with that is it causes a lot of symptoms. Obviously, people feel palpitations.
Mm-hmm.
They feel their heart racing. It causes people to be short of breath, fatigue, but it also causes strokes.
Mm.
Because blood can kind of pool in the top chambers because the top chambers are not squeezing appropriately, so blood will pool in crevices in the top chamber, form little blood clots, which is a stroke risk.
Mm-hmm.
We have sort of a two-pronged thing. You got a growing epidemic of coronary disease in young people, which we're learning to, through some of these technologies, pick up on, treat earlier and earlier, which is going to do great. I think in the studies have shown it really improves long-term mortality rates and things like that. But then you shift over and that leaves a large burden of people who are having arrhythmia issues, stuff mm-hmm. like that later in life.
Are some of the signs similar for like arrhythmia and for...
Can be. I mean, I've got
stroke or what are some of the warning signs?
The classical warning signs for like a plaque, a heart attack, things like that, or chest pain, increasing shortness of breath with activity.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've found is, you know, everyone's different and their symptoms are all a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Most like blockage related symptoms do tend to be either an acute process, which is like a heart attack. So that's what I tell people, if you just sit at home and you get crushing chest pain or get horribly short of breath, you need to go to the emergency room because they have the capability to evaluate that quickly and it needs to be evaluated quickly. A more chronic progressive thing is either exertional chest discomfort, chest tightness, mm-hmm. chest pain, or exertional shortness of breath. That's from a heart perspective. Strokes tend to be acute. So you have...
What is a stroke?
So there are two broad categories of stroke. One is a hemorrhagic stroke, mm-hmm. which is essentially a hemorrhage or bleed in the mm-hmm. brain. Those are very hard to predict, very hard to, those generally occur with aneurysms or high blood pressure, things like that. The much more common type of stroke is an ischemic stroke, which means that you occlude a blood vessel and you lose blood flow to a part of the brain. Mm-hmm. Atrial fibrillation, the heart arrhythmia, causes that because those clots in the heart get tossed out.
That's what I was wondering.
And will actually plug an artery going to the brain. But you also get the same atherosclerotic plaque that causes plaque to the heart will cause plaque to the brain. Carotid arteries are higher, and you can form little blood clots on a plaque erosion, or that's the most common cause, and can cause an acute stroke. Again, those are both emergent things. Mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, if you get slurred speech, facial droop, you can't move your arm or leg, become a tingling all on one side or the other, you need to go to the emergency room. And there are, our hospitals are well prepared. The emergency rooms are well prepared with stroke protocols. So there are protocols set up to rush those people in, get them evaluated, and if they are candidates, give them the appropriate treatment mm-hmm. for that.
So do strokes happen anywhere in the body or just the brain?
A stroke is technically just the brain.
Okay, but it could come from a blockage in your heart that goes to your brain.
Well, it can come from a blood clot in your heart, but the same process, it can also come from a blockage like in one of the carotid arteries in your neck.
Okay.
That feeds the carotids and the vertebral arteries feed the brain blood. And the brain is a very unforgiving organ. It does not like a lack of blood flow. And so very quickly, you can have a serious problem. The plaque, the process that develops plaque to the heart arteries mm-hmm. is a body-wide phenomenon. So it is not just limited. You don't just see atherosclerosis and plaque in the heart artery and nowhere else. It's everywhere. You see it in the aorta, which is the main blood vessel. You see it in the legs and mm-hmm. the arteries that go to the legs. You see it in the arteries that go to the brain. So you see it developing everywhere. And really, that's part of what we have to do is when we see people who have atherosclerotic plaque somewhere, you really have to at least screen with, do you have any pain in your legs when you walk, in the muscles of your legs when you walk? Well, that could be a blockage that's preventing blood flow to your legs. Have you had neurologic symptoms to suggest that maybe you're having a lack of blood flow intermittently to your brain?
Mm-hmm. Rebel Rabbit is on a mission to provide a healthier and smarter way to socialize and drink. They're alcohol-free. Cannabis-infused seltzers are perfect for anybody just trying to kick back and relax after a hard day at work or on the golf course with your friends or hanging out at a party and you want to wake up and feel better the next day. Their seltzers are perfect for you. They are a great alternative to alcohol as well. Their website is drinkrebelrabbit.com. Use promo code LIFE20. You'll get 20% off your order. That link is in the show notes. But join the mission and start drinking and socializing smarter with Rebel Rabbit Seltzers.
What about a heart attack? What causes a heart attack?
So a classical heart attack is actually, interestingly enough, what we find is what we call a STEMI.
Okay.
Which is an ST elevation MI, which most heart attacks are created by not a severe block. You may have a 30-40% blockage or narrowing, but the plaque has vulnerable characteristics. And that's like a lot of lipid in the plaque. There are different changes in the plaque that make it more what we call vulnerable.
Okay.
When you get a vulnerable plaque, if it ruptures, so a plaque will rupture or change acutely and you form a blood clot on mm-hmm. that plaque. So if you think about it, instead of the artery slowly, slowly narrowing mm-hmm. over a period of time, well, the heart can kind of get used to that and can make some physiologic adjustments to help, at least to a certain point, protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
But if you acutely go from full flow to nothing because a plaque is ruptured and you form a big blood clot on it, well, that is what that is the typical and the classical acute heart attack. And those are the episodes that have very typical EKG findings.
Mm-hmm.
those are the episodes that if you call 911 from your home and you're having chest pain and they come out and they can do a 12-lead EKG at your home.
Gotcha.
If you have evidence of that, they will activate our system, our emergency system, and go straight to, in our system's case, the Spartanburg Regional, to the Heart Center. We have cath teams on call. We have 24/7, 365. I mean, all the time. And those patients don't even stop in the ER. They go straight through. They're diagnosed in the field. Their EKGs are transmitted to our staff mm-hmm. who are evaluating. They go straight to the cath lab. Our goal is to do a heart cath and get a stent in, get them revascularized, mm-hmm. get the blood flow back within 90 minutes of first medical contact. So that's medical contact in the field. And mm-hmm. we do a pretty good job of that. I mean, we've done very well with being able to improve our protocols to the point where we're getting people in quickly.
Yeah. You mentioned it at the beginning, but like recovery and, you know, once somebody has a stroke or a heart attack, what is the process for them to like get back to normal activity and how is that improved?
Well, it's a different process for the two problems. From a heart perspective, you want to get them I think the first aspect of either is you want to make sure the blood flow is good.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get, if there's a blockage, you got to fix it.
Yeah.
Okay. After that, from a stroke perspective, it really becomes much of a physical therapy, maybe speech therapy, mm-hmm. occupational therapy. It's a therapy issue to recondition, strengthen, and get your neurologic deficits improved.
Yep.
From a cardiac perspective, which is what we deal with a lot more, it really involves a cardiac rehab process. And we have a cardiac rehab center. And so anyone who's had a heart attack or has had bypass surgery or has had a stent,
mm-hmm.
has had any of these, is referred over to our cardiac rehab center. And the system is developing some, we just opened a cardiac rehab center in Gaffney.
Cool.
So we're trying to put these near where the patients are.
Mm-hmm.
From a cardiac perspective, cardiac rehab is a very regimented process of 2, 3, 4 times a week, as much as the patient can. They go in, the staff will check all of them, see how they're doing, see if they're making sure they're on their medicines.
Yep.
And then they will do observed exercise.
Gotcha.
So they'll put them on a treadmill or on a bike. They'll have them walk.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have them, and they monitor their heart rhythm and all that sort of stuff. And they work them through a process of re-strengthening and improving their conditioning. At the same time, they really work through things like some diet.
Yeah, some lifestyle stuff.
Yeah, lifestyle things, smoking cessation, diet changes, mm-hmm. things like that. And so they try to, by the end of that process, have people not only physically better, but from a mental perspective in a better frame of mind that they can go back into their normal activities and normal life.
With some wearables, because there's all these wearables nowadays, is there a wearable you've used or you like to use? And what are some of those data points? Like I hear a lot about HRV, obviously heart rate in general.
Yeah, we're still learning a lot about some of the variables and what that means. Clearly, if you have really high heart rate variability, can be a precursor to rhythm issues, things like that. I use wearables mostly on a diagnostic level. There's an app called a Cardia app for your phone. There's also some of the newest model Apple Watches have mm-hmm. really good rhythm discrimination.
Yeah.
So for people who have palpitations, or most especially people who have atrial fibrillation intermittently,
mm-hmm.
those watches actually are very pretty good. And so the patients can oftentimes, even if they're not feeling symptoms, if they go into some of these rhythms, a watch will notify them.
Sure. I've got some like funny notifications on my watch.
Yeah. You know, the whole problem, and we struggle a little bit, you know, our modern society, we have so much data.
Yeah. And I had to stop wearing a wearable because I was getting so stressed about my numbers.
And so I try to tell people, in the appropriate setting, it is a useful tool,
mm-hmm.
but you can't become so obsessed with it that it drives you crazy.
Yeah.
And that is, we get reams and reams and reams and reams of data
mm-hmm.
at this point. And that's really becoming one of the hard things about being a physician, is how do you sift through
all of it,
all of this yeah. data that you get from the patient, from the medical record, from medical records elsewhere, from, you know, and with AI developing and stuff like that, it's just going to get.
Yeah.
And
are you using tools for AI to read?
So the CT program has a functional. So when we do coronary CT, we have a functional evaluation of a blockage that is a program that is based on AI that was developed out of Stanford. There are AI programs to automate
mm-hmm.
cardiac ultrasound, so that it, for measurements mm-hmm. of and things to try to speed the process of acquiring the information. We still have not really moved into allowing a computer to diagnose.
Yes.
And that's, you know,
maybe
that opens a whole other ball of wax. I don't know. I'm kind of old school, but I that's going to be a ways
yeah.
before people really turn over their, feel comfortable turning over their care.
I think it's a great tool to read, and then, you know, it's just going to make sorting that data hopefully easier for you.
Well, all the big tech companies now, I mean, they're setting up AI capability to try to help deal with all the data. And that is one thing that I think is a useful, if you can try to collate all the data
mm-hmm.
through AI and other things to try to, I was just at a conference and they were giving a talk on this that the goal is to sort of collate the data and give what the data would suggest mm-hmm. is an issue, but still leave it to clinical
yeah.
judgment and the physician to work through.
Yeah.
Just to try to
make it easier for you to read, hopefully.
Right. Streamline.
With like myths around heart health and stuff, you know, there's all those things like wine could be good for your health there. What is your thoughts on alcohol and heart health? And
I mean, pretty typically the studies have shown that very light alcohol use is probably okay.
Yeah.
I don't think it has to do with red wine. It seems to be more alcohol, but that is like one drink a
yeah.
day. And by drink, I mean, you're talking about it.
The actual alcohol.
The actual alcohol.
Yeah.
What the studies have clearly shown is if you go much over that, it flips
yeah.
and it is detrimental. And so I tell people, you know, you can drink, well, you know, a half glass to a glass of red wine a day and that be it. I don't think there's a problem with it. If you don't think you can do that and it turns into three or four glasses, then you probably just don't need
yeah.
to drink alcohol at all. It just depends.
With you in your free time, you've mentioned you got two kids in school now. What is what's life like for you outside of work?
Well, right now, between work and since COVID, has been very busy.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very busy.
You're not pulling for the tide, man?
I am. I've spent more time than usual looking at the Alabama sites to see with the new coach coming in and with Saban retiring. My kids have been somewhat distraught. I'm trying to get them through that. I used to play golf.
I was about to say, play golf?
I used to play golf. Haven't played much lately. I do a lot of yard work, gardening.
It's good for your mind, man.
I like to get out and cut grass and work in. That's what I spent the weekend enlarging my garden so I can plant a garden here in a couple of weeks.
You sound like my dad, man.
Engineered Sleep makes the best mattresses out there. Sleep is the number one thing you can focus on right now to better your performance on a daily basis, and you might as well be sleeping on an Engineered Sleep mattress. Like I said, their products are the best, and their customer service is second to none. Their website is engineeredsleep.com. If you use promo code LIVE15, you'll get 15% off your order. So if you or someone you know is looking for a new mattress, reach out to the team at Engineered Sleep, and they'll hook you up. Again, their website is engineeredsleep.com. Use promo code LIVE15 to get 15% off your order.
With the future of cardiology, do you see anything on the like new advances coming or things that maybe aren't here yet but you are excited about?
Sure. I mean, there are always, medical knowledge is doubling, like, I think every 70-something days, which is incredible. It used to be when I was in med school, it was like every 9 months. Now it's there are always new advancements. There are a lot of procedural advancements. As far as from a population health perspective, I think the CT aspect of things is going to be the big thing over the next few years as we institute changes into that. And then you have a lot of procedures for like heart failure, you know, that are developing. There are always a lot of clinical trials. There are always a lot of new medicines coming out.
Yep.
So care continues to evolve. And, you know, we have to sort of be very cognizant and ready to adapt.
Sure. Because it's going to be coming, yeah. With last question, if somebody was curious, they think they might have an issue, they think they might have some symptoms, they think they might have some signs, like, what would your suggestion be to them?
Again, acute problems probably are going to be addressed in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. So I always tell people, if it's something really bad and it's acute, then you probably need to go get checked. If it's something that they're concerned about, do they have underlying atherosclerosis, do they have plaque, then I would talk to your family physician. I think a calcium score is an excellent way to start if you don't have symptoms. If you do have symptoms, like if you're developing more shortness of breath or a little bit of chest discomfort when you're active or things like that, then the CT is really the next step. Mm-hmm. In that. Referral to a cardiology office is a reasonable thing to get evaluated. And then that takes you down the pathway of knowing. And knowledge is very important for patients, because if they know what is going on, if they understand what's going on, then we have all sorts of treatment options. Mm-hmm. At this point. Getting into that pathway and getting into that environment will help them understand what they have and understand what they need to do to make sure they live as long and as healthy as they can.
Definitely. Well, actually, I have one more question.
Sure.
I've always heard that some people are born with a hole in their heart. What is that?
So there are different holes in your heart. There are ventricular or atrial septal defects, which are holes between the top and bottom chambers of the heart. Those are, if they're of any size, those are normally picked up in childhood.
Okay.
There is actually a very small hole that is what's called a patent foramen ovale, which is actually about 10 to 15% of the population. Actually, when we were starting the CT program, I was a guinea pig and had a CT performed on myself. Well, I'm a whole, I had a PFO.
Dang.
Lived 50 years and not known it. A PFO, there is normally a hole in the heart when a baby is in uterus.
Mm-hmm.
Developing, because if you think about it, the baby's in amniotic fluid, it's not breathing with its lungs. So blood, which has oxygen that's coming from the placenta, gets routed across this hole. But when the baby is born, that hole should close and seal. And,
got it.
And there is a percentage of the people where it closes, but baby doesn't fully seal, mm-hmm. and you can get communication. Big risk for that is really, it has been associated with strokes, particularly strokes in young adults.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really recommend that you go looking for it because it's not, you know, in the end, it's 10% of the population. It's hard to find sometimes without some really fancy and advanced imaging. And a lot of times, even if you have it, it doesn't cause any mm-hmm. problems. Actually, most of the time, even if you have it, it doesn't cause any problems. So, but yeah, that's the big one, the biggest one that you'd normally see in clinical practice is a PFO.
Well, Dr. Mobley, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me and educate me on cardiology and heart health and all that good stuff. And it's been a pleasure and a great conversation. So thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Give our partners some love by visiting their links in the show notes. Spink's Convenience Stores, you can find the location nearest you. Rebel Rabbit Seltzers, they're on a mission to socialize healthier and smarter, so join the mission. And Engineered Sleep, making the best mattresses in the game. You might as well be sleeping on an Engineered Sleep mattress. For me, if you could give our show a 5-star rating on your listening platform, that'd be greatly appreciated. And thank you so much for listening.